All right. How you doing? Mike Lapatino here. Of course, now you got me on the podcast. Oh, I love this technology. And someone who's not technology disabled at all is the guest I have right now, Jeff Skunk Baxter. Jeff, how you doing, man?
So far, so good.
Yeah, man. You know, I've been in radio 35 years, you know, and in the early days of broadcasting, the way us frustrated musicians, see, we couldn't play music. That's why we became disc jockeys. Would read liner notes. That's how you got to know all about the bands and all about the personnel. And I feel as though I've known you more than half my life because, you know, playing rock records all the time back in the day of the, you know, 70s and 80s. I mean, your name comes up an awful lot you know, being a guitar player, of course, with Doobie Brothers and Steely Dan and just, you know, being like guest musicians, a lot of studio work. And I never knew this in reading a biography that you actually first got to play was the Hendrix.
Yeah, actually sold and traded for his first Stratocaster when I was working down at Jimmy's Music Shop down 48th Street, and I got a chance to play with him for a very short time. His band Jimmy James and the Blue Flames.
Right, and at that time, I mean, you were like a teenager.
Yeah.
And he probably wasn't that much older than you were. But what was your early thoughts, recollections when you saw this guy? I mean,
Well, I was awestruck. I just thought he was in his whole approach to playing the guitar was something to me that was fresh, and he was to me what John Coltrane was to Bebop.
Mm-hmm. And being of a younger age, I mean, was that any sort of inspiration? Because as far as I'm concerned, you're probably, I think, one of the best guitar players around. I mean, the stuff that you do.
That's very kind.
Well, it's the truth, you know. I mean, the music speaks volumes, man. And just, you know, I never got to see you play. I'm going to be doing the show Saturday night, so I'm really tickled to see you and all the other guys that are going to be there as well.
Some wonderful players.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, it's like, this is the thing that gets me. You said, starting off in radio in the early days and reading all these liner notes, that's how you got to know a lot of these people. I can't say that a lot of these guys that are playing are household names, but I'll guarantee you, everyone's heard their music.
You know?
And to be able to see this is just going to be incredible. But you figure when you met this Hendrix at that time, this is before he was a household name. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't remember the those early days. I think, did he ever play with the Isley Brothers? I think at one time
he did, and I think when he came into the shop, he had just finished doing a gig with Joey D and the Starlighters, I think.
Okay.
And he had formed a band called Jimmy James and the Blue Flames.
And the Blue Flames, yeah.
Out of the Cheetah. There's a lot of music going on back in the early and middle 60s. It was an incredible time to be in New York.
You know, and it's funny because I say this to a lot of, like, my kids, you know, who are in their 20s now. And to grow up, and I was on the young end, like when the Beatles came out, I was like 10, 11 years old, but I remember that, you know, it was such an important time in our history, and especially in music history, and the genre of rock and roll, you know, which pretty much started like in the 50s, has continued now for over 60 years, you know, and I think in the history of music, that's like the longest genre of music that's been that popular, that's been passed down to the generations. I know growing up, you know, my parents listened to the big bands and Sinatra and you know, torch singers. And there was definitely that gap. Nowadays, you go to college, and I'm sure when you play live, I mean, you'll see kids with their parents. You know, they're sharing the same music.
That's true. But don't forget Beethoven, Bach, Chopin, Mozart. Don't forget those guys. There's a genre of music that's been around for a while.
It has been. It hasn't been as popular, but it has been.
Oh, that's true.
It has been around that long, of course. And has that set the pace for music today? I mean, that can be a discussion we can have that can last for hours.
It has. I mean, when I listened to, well, I studied classical piano when I was very young, and it's amazing to me when I look at and played Beethoven, how much the country ballads came out of that music. It's also interesting when you, I mean, you probably heard Pachelbel's Canon a bazillion times at everybody's wedding, but you realize there's the same chord changes as every great R&B ballad ever written. So, you know, there's a definite connection timeline to the, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Though I really, you know, like to look back at, you know, the beginning of like the rock and roll era is just the, you know, a division coming out of the, you know, the great blues players of the South, the Delta and Chicago. And, you know, back in the 30s, Robert Johnson's you know, that's where, to me, that's like the birth of rock and roll, of that genre of that, you know,
that's very true.
You know, where those guys got their inspiration. I don't know if it was from classical or not. I thought it's pretty much just from, you know, their lives. It was spiritual, more or less, you know. And
well, but much of the spiritual music came from religious music, and a lot of that religious mm-hmm. music came from the great composers in Europe, because they created what in many cases became the standards, if you want to call it,
right,
for church services and religion.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a really interactive, very connected timeline. But yeah, I'm with you. When I first heard Elvis, and when I first heard The Ventures, and so I went pretty crazy.
And it's funny because I've watched some videos of you, and it could have been at one of these conventions, and I'm not sure what guitar company that you were representing. It could have been Gibson, maybe. I'm not sure. Not that it makes a difference, but you would play, you know, oh, well, here's rock, and you play like rock chords or leads and shit, and then you'd go over to country, and then go over to jazz, and it's like, and you've been, I mean, you seem to do that with equal precision on all levels. And that's why I always loved listening to you play guitar, because I think it's,
well, thank
you know.
Thank you. I've been a studio musician for like 45 years. Well, so I guess during that time, you sort of osmose enough styles so that hopefully, you know, the playing becomes a little more eclectic. We try.
Well, and it also gets you work, too.
I mean, I never had a problem getting work. That's true. Knock on wood.
I don't think you ever will either. I mean, just looking at the itinerary of people that you've played with, and again, being a liner note reader, it's hard to do it now with CDs, and even that is a thing of the past.
Right.
That's the one thing about technology that I'm very upset about is not having the, you know, the information there that I used to love to read so much. But
yeah, I used to miss reading the old liner notes, and a lot of the jazz guys, they would list the microphones that were used. So I love that stuff.
That was great stuff. I mean, not only did the album jacket serve as a great way to roll weed on, but it also was a great source of information, you know? It worked.
Well, I like the information. I really did. I appreciate that, especially for a guy like me, a tech head.
Yeah, you know.
And, to me, that was all about that.
And me being a disc jockey, it gave me all the information I needed to sound like I knew what I was talking about. When you'd go on the air and talk about, oh, that was Jeff Skunk Baxter doing the lead on, you know, Ricky Don't Lose That Number or with a dupe, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, it was good. But I've noticed, though, you prefer being a studio musician more than just joining a band, because you were with both those bands, you know, for a short amount of time on the road. And it seems, though, you seem to want, as you say, be a studio, right? You like to just work in a studio.
Well, it's a bit of a myth about Steely Dan. Steely Dan actually did quite a few live shows.
Mm-hmm.
Band toured pretty hard, as they should, you know, in the beginning. We played. I played with them for about 3 years.
And that was in 70. That was the first year they were more or less together as Steely Dan, right, in 72?
Well, the first three albums. Yeah,
right.
We went
and
toured all of that. And then because Steely Dan had opened a number of shows with the Doobie Brothers, I ended up sort of playing in both bands, and so found it sort of transitioning from one to the other, and then played really with the Doobies until around 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of time on the road, played with Linda Ronstadt, toured with her, and a number of other folks. I enjoyed the touring part of it, but I always felt that being a studio musician was a goal and a capability that was worthwhile maintaining, because I don't know. I guess I like being top gun. I liked being one of the first call guys, and I thought that was a mark of achievement, and I took a lot of pride in it. It meant a lot to me.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny when you talk about the early days of Steely Dan, and you're right, because a lot of people haven't thought of them as a touring band, because I think by the time they reached the peak of their popularity, and like with the Asia album, though the first three, Camp by a Thrill, Countdown to Ecstasy, Pretzel Logic, to me are incredibly awesome albums. You know, but I don't think there were, back in those days, they weren't being played on AM. FM guys were playing them, so they weren't getting the mass. And then when people started to, oh man, did you hear that Ricky Lose That Number One song's, you know, 6-7 years old now. They became more of like a studio band, and that's
right, that's true.
Yeah, but they're touring now. They're out on the road this year, as a matter of fact. They're actually doing a couple of dates in Connecticut. So, ever think about getting back with them, or you still talk with them at all? Or
occasionally, yeah. But no, I'm very happy doing what I'm doing. I'm actually, for the first time in my life, spent the past 2 years working on a solo project with an incredible keyboard player, producer, or engineer like me, friend of mine named C.J. Vanston. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll be finished with all this by June, and then I'll go out and play a little bit. I've never done anything on my own. I've always been everybody else's guitar player, so yeah. Maybe it's time to go out and have some fun and do what I like to do.
Well, this weekend, you're going to be at the Palace Theater in Waterbury. I don't know if you ever played there back in the day. They used to have a lot of shows there back in the 70s and early 80s, and then it got really run down, and then the city of Waterbury several years ago renovated the theater completely, and it's just the way it used to look. It's one of those great 2,000-seat theaters. It's got the loge. It's got the side boxes. It's just such a great venue. And I think this thing, the Legends from Boston, I think it all started as a tribute to James Cotton originally, and it seems to have morphed into this like almost like a yearly thing. And the amount of talent that's playing here, and I'm sure you know probably a lot of these guys.
Oh yeah,
is just, as I said before, they may not be household names, but damn, you've heard their music. You know, there's no doubt about it. With you got Magic Dick and Danny Klein from Jay Giles, another guy who, you know, not a household name. I consider him one of those, you know, one of those unsung guitar heroes. He's a guy that can do a guitar lick in a song and keep it under 30 seconds. Is Elliot Easton from the Cars.
I mean, this guy, I love Elliot. Yeah. Elliot was the guy that originally called me to do this.
Oh, really? I mean,
yeah.
but on the Cars, like all the Cars songs, they're about 3 to 5 minutes in length max. But his licks in it are concise, short, and they just kick ass. You know, I've always liked this guy, you know. And but again, he's, I don't think a name anybody knows. And Greg Hawks on keyboards, of course, you know, John Butcher. I remember interviewing him years ago with the John Butcher Axes. And David Hall. David Hall, I think, was a Connecticut boy one time. I used to play with a guy named Charlie Karp. I don't know if you knew Charlie at all. He was an old friend of mine from Westport, Connecticut. But
well, I went to school near Waterbury. I went to a school in Watertown. I went to a place called Taft.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So you'll
be myself and Mary Chapin Carpenter and the guitar player from Fish. He went to Taft.
Oh, not Trey. Trey Anastasio?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, now, what do you think of him as a guitar player? Have you seen him play?
Yeah, I like his guitar playing because it's imaginative. I mean, I'm more than happy to sit down and, you know, work my way through, you know, very extensive, complicated, complex arrangements. I mean, I love that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, it's really about soul. I mean, one of the things about Bo Diddley that I always found fascinating is he really only knew one chord. But I could listen to him play that chord for hours.
The Bo Diddley sound, man, you can't, you're right.
Because there was something so magical and so visceral about it. So, I'm a big fan of technique, and I think that's really important.
Yeah.
But that's when you mentioned Elliot Easton. Elliot is a really fine guitar player. But the trick is not to play everything that you know in 30 seconds, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
You play what you do what's right for the music, and that's the mark of an excellent player to me. Is a person that is there to subsume to the music. If they ask you to step out, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like when you listen to the big bands, those guys, every once in a while, those guys got a chance to step out. But the reason that they were doing what they were doing is because each of those musicians had this unbelievably depth of talent to be able to work together and make an arrangement just
right.
Soar.
Sounds like you're talking about just that's you. I think in a nutshell, I think you can you can do that. Another guy that comes to mind is Steve Cropper. Another guy that you know he's you know does he stand out and stand on his head and play guitar behind his back? No, but with him and Don Dunn, I mean to me it's like what a band. I mean it's like these guys are you know just. They can do that. If you need them to step out, I'm sure they can. They can improvise for an hour. But you're right. It's that kind of.
Crop is a great player.
Yeah.
And when I was, I produced quite a few albums as a producer,
mm-hmm.
and for the vast majority of them, I'd have Steve play or have Steve on the date, even if he didn't play. I didn't care. There was something about having Crop in the studio. That was just what I needed.
Yeah.
And sometimes he wouldn't play. And the fact that he wouldn't play told me that I had everything that I needed.
No.
And that's as important to me as having him play. I mean, it was, that to me, that's what you don't play. I mean, I remember one time Gary Katz, one of the producer for Steely Dan, asked me to come in, and he was working on a project. And it was at the end of the record, and he said, listen, I want you to come in, and I want you to listen to everything. And put down and what you need. And I brought all my gear. I had the cartage guy bring, 8,000 tons of cars and amplifiers. Sat and listened to the whole album. And I said, Gary, you don't need a thing. And he said, that's why I pay you triple scale. I wanted to hear that. Okay. That's
nice.
That's it. So it's really what you don't play in a lot of times. It's the holes that you leave.
Yeah.
It's spaces. It's what you don't play. It's important.
I got to meet him once. It was Dave Edmunds. I guess 15 years ago, 20, did like a rock and roll review where he went out and pretty similar to like this Legends of Boston, but this was a while ago. And he was one of the players in the band. I think Kim Wilson was one of the vocal. I think was one of the a great front man. And but I got to meet him and Don Dunn backstage, and it was. It was really a thrill. I'm looking forward to this Saturday night. I can't even begin to tell you because there's guys there who I haven't met that I'm dying to meet and watch play, like you, Elliot Easton, of course, and I've had Magic Dick on the show before. I've never met Danny Klein and James Montgomery. He used to come to a place called Toad's Place in New Haven a lot. I used to see him all the time, and he used to.
James was my roommate in college.
Was he really? He's a great.
Yeah, we've been friends for a long time. What a. An amazing player.
Yeah, incredible, and I love it. I love it. And I still have his business card, James Montgomery, blues man.
And boy, if anybody deserves that title, it's him.
But he went out, and I believe him when he says that he got Johnny Winter back on the straight and narrow somewhat, and because he was touring with Johnny Winter a couple of years ago. And he said he did only because he wanted to get Johnny back into shape, got him to exercise a little bit. And, you know, he's another great guy to see. I'm sure he's got his, you know, his physical ailments. I mean, you could see that. But I think at one time when he was really out there, imbibing and not doing anything good for his health, James seems to have taken credit to get him on the straight and narrow. And the last time I saw Johnny Winter, which was about a month ago, I tell you, man, that boy, I mean, he only played for about an hour, but, man, that boy can play.
Well, I would, knowing James like I do, I know he wouldn't take credit for anything that he didn't do, and it's an interesting insight into James's personality that would be the motivation.
Yeah, he's
to do something not just his own to further his own career, but to look out, reach out.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
People.
Yeah, he's a good man. It'd be a lot of fun to see James, and then they added Gary Hoey to the show. And I'm sure Gary's another guy, not a household name, except for his Hoey Christmas CDs, which are great. But he's going to be there too. Another guy that's pretty talented as well.
Well, when Elliot called me,
mm-hmm.
Easton called me, and I looked at the lineup. I mean, again, most of these guys I've known for many, many years, and it seems to me it's more like. Let's all get together in some place and have a lot of fun and maybe we'll invite some other people, like the audience. It's. I'm not saying that it's not a show, because it is.
Yes.
But I'm really, really looking forward to spending musical time with people that I really care about. And I'm glad that other people are interested in coming and you know, kind of watching and participating. This should be an awful lot of fun. I have a feeling that all kinds of things are going to happen.
Yeah.
That weren't rehearsed and weren't charted out.
Well, that's going to be
the looking forward to that.
And that's going to be the fun of it, is getting together with a lot of these guys and as you said, playing, and then in front of a live audience as well, getting that kind of feedback. I mean, it does. It sounds like it's going to be like this big party, you know. So
yeah, I think so, and I know there's going to be some certainly magical moments that are those once in a lifetime, never happen again kind of things. So
absolutely,
I'm looking forward to that.
That's the kind of stuff I like. I mean, and you're right. That's exactly the kind of things that we can look forward to. It's going to be this Saturday night. The Blues All Star. Well, it's not really called the Blues All Stars.
They call it the Boston All-Stars.
The Boston Legends.
So many of us played in, you know, different bands in Boston.
Right, exactly. Area. Not necessarily that you guys are all from Boston. Not that that's a bad thing. But I'm just saying that it's that's just what they're calling it. And I think it's cool. Boston Legends All-Star Concerts, Saturday night at the Palace Theater in Waterbury. Tickets are on sale now. So if I get there early and bring my guitar, can you give me a quick couple of lessons to get up there and jam with you guys?
Yeah, I am so open to anything. I'm telling you, if you want to play, it's fine with me.
I'd set your career way back. You wouldn't.
I'm not quite sure that's true. I think the question is, if anybody can contribute, that's all that counts. It doesn't have to be. Again, if Bo Diddley, I would jam with him. Yeah, okay. I'm happy to do that.
You know,
George Thorogood's another guitar player that's certainly not known for his, you know, brilliant improvisational jazz technique, but I love playing with him. I got on stage with him one night at the House of Blues just to play maracas because I wanted to. I just loved what he does.
Oof.
And I was having just a great time playing maracas.
And maracas, and maracas go great with a Bo Diddley beat, you know? You can't beat
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I was having way too much fun.
Hey, how well did you know, because I'm looking at your bio, Carl Wilson. To me, I thought he had the voice of an angel.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable. Oh, I'm telling you. Losing him was losing an angel on earth. It really was. Did you get close with him? Did you work a lot with him?
We did. I did one of his solo records. We spent a lot of time playing together, and we became really good friends. He's a pretty amazing guy in that he was one of those. I don't want to condemn the human race, but I could not find in him an angry bone in his body. Mm-hmm. His outlook was so joyous and so open, and I hate to use the word loving because it connotates other things, but yeah, loving. Mm-hmm. His heart was so big. To work with him in the studio, I was melting. I mean, I'm trying to produce this record, and I'm not producing. I'm listening, and I gotta wait. Whoa! I gotta wake up here.
Yeah,
I'm producing this record. It was an absolute honor to work with that man.
Yeah. He's just, I tell you, the vocals on him are just unbelievable. We'll never see anything like it. I'm telling you.
Well, after you hear God Only Knows, I'm really not sure what else there is left.
Yeah, exactly. It just, and again, I never, ever get tired of listening to that song.
Oh, my God.
I just don't. It sounds better every time I hear it. And I've heard it for so many years. It's just unbelievable.
And I got a call from Billy Henchy about a year ago to do some stuff on some liner notes. I guess they're re-releasing the Youngblood album that I did with them. I'm not saying that to get people to go out and buy it so much, to listen to more of his voice.
Yeah.
God, just unbelievable.
Yeah. You know, being the talent you are, and I'm just not blowing smoke up your ass or anything. I really do admire you. I'm starstruck talking with you. I'm just trying to sound really cool, you know. But
You're very kind.
And I never, but seriously, you are just, I've always, you know, as I said, I felt like I've known you for 35 years. Only because I've seen your name on, you know, liner notes and listened to the music that you've played on, and knowing the people that you've played with, you know, from Joni Mitchell to Carly Simon, and that era of the, and I hate it when they call it soft rock, but I guess I don't know that, but there was at a time in the late 70s when disco was huge, and you either wore a polyester shirt or you wore a flannel shirt, you know. And I was a flannel shirt guy, you know, Allman Brothers and rock and roll and stuff, Carly Simon and James Taylor and a lot of that great music that came out. That you were a part of a lot of those sessions.
I was a session sausage, and my job was to go play on a Carly record, and then go play on a Richie Havens record, and then go play on a Donna Summer record. And it really, you know, it didn't make any difference to me what it was. The joy was being able to be a part of some unbelievable artists, whether they were disco or whether they were, you know, Carly Simon. I was just my job was to stand by, do the best I could, and try to make that music, you know. Even the Dolly Parton stuff, I love doing that stuff.
Everybody knows her as her vocals and her personality in movies, but she's a good musician in her own right, isn't she?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And people don't know that, because I've seen her play guitar and I'm saying, man, this chick is all right.
You bet.
Yeah, no, I admire her. I really do. It sounds like you got a call coming in. I'm not even going to talk about the missiles and all that crap, because I think that's not what it's all about with you. You know, I mean, that's great that you did the, I don't know what the hell you did with the guided missiles. I don't know, you going into outer space or that kind of shit. I don't know. But,
well, I love my country, and I've had the opportunity to serve my country for about 20 years, and it means a lot.
And it's a very good thing, too. But you know what? We're all about music this afternoon, and that's where that's where we're going to keep it. We will see you this coming Saturday night at the Palace Theater in Waterbury. Can't wait to see the show. I'm really looking forward to it, and I really thank you, Jeff, for taking the time out and talking with me.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
All right, Jeff Skunk Baxter. This coming Saturday night at the Palace Theater. Thanks, pal.